Number 07-1206 et al. Northeast Beverage Corporation et al. Petitioners versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Budd for the petitioners. Mr. Fleischer for the respondent. Mr. Adler for the intervener.
Your Honors, my name's Thomas Budd. I'm the counsel for the petitioners, Northeast Beverage Corporation, Viva Trana Distributors. The case before the court, the significant issue in the case before the court is whether the activities engaged in by employees on May 29th, I believe it was 2002, were protected under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, or as petitioner claims were unprotected activities. And there's two bases for declaring them unprotected. One is that they violated the no-strike, no-lockout provision contained in the collective bargaining agreement. And the other relates to various cases which conclude that employees who walk off the job, take away from work time for the purpose of attending union meetings where there's no specific dispute and issue at the time, are engaging in unprotected activities. I'll start first with the collective bargaining agreement issue, because I believe under any standard, the collective bargaining agreement between the parties clearly prohibited the activities which occurred on May 29th. Article 16 of that agreement has various provisions. The ALJ below relied only on Section 1, a provision which states that if the union authorizes certain activities, in particular work stoppage, strike, or disruption of the normal operations of the business, that prohibition only went to activities of that sort, job actions of that sort, which were authorized by the union, and therefore the employees here engaged in an unauthorized action and were not prohibited by the no-strike clause. The problem with the ALJ's analysis is the failure to read Section 4 of the same no-strike clause. In particular, although Section 1 is not a prohibitive section, it doesn't prohibit anything. It only is a representation by the union that it will not authorize certain kinds of activities, walkouts and strikes and disruptions. Section 4 is a prohibitive section. Section 4 says that employees engage in, quote, such job actions without any reference to them as being authorized or unauthorized, violate the contract and are subject to discharge and discipline.
Can I ask about that? I quite well understand what you mean when you say such job actions, with the argument that in Section 2 and Section 3, your argument that it applies to both authorized and unauthorized, and what it really applies to is strikes, work stoppages, or concerted interferences. But it's that last phrase that you said, that such employees who participate violate the agreement. And it's not really what it says. It just says the employees who instigate or participate in such job actions in violation of this agreement shall be subjected. If it said that they violate it, you would be right there with the plain language. But where does it explain what is in violation of this agreement?
Well, the agreement in Section 3 provides that certain the union has to take certain actions in order to keep itself from being liable, and it describes those actions, and it describes the obligations they have to make them unauthorized. So such job actions refers to the
not the such job actions. What about what does in violation of this agreement mean?
Well, the violation of the agreement is the job actions described. They might be described in Section 1, but a work stoppage is not something which is still a job action, whether it's authorized or not. A strike is still a job action, whether it's authorized or not. Concerted interference with the operations of the employer are still job actions, whether authorized or not. And those are the job actions which Section 4, it seems to me, clearly are referring to when it says in violations of. In any event, it seems to me that the reliance of the board on Silver State Disposal is misplaced, because that provision only had that contract only had a Section 1 type provision. It did not have a Section 4 type provision. So if my recollection of Silver State is it merely said you can't authorize certain actions, but went no further in discussing what would happen to employees who engaged in them. Section 4 clearly says that when employees engage in some kind of action, job action, and it seems to me the only job actions you could look at the contract and rely upon are those described in Section 1, whether authorized or not authorized, are subject to discharge. I mean, it clearly says that. Now, going further, you have the Roos testimony, Mr. Roos being the president of the union. And there's a lot of discussion in the board's decision about whether Mr. Roos understood what a wildcat strike was or what a wildcat strike wasn't. It's hard for me to believe that somebody in labor relations long term has got to be president of a Teamsters local doesn't know that a wildcat strike is an unauthorized strike during the course of a contract. But be that as it may, it really isn't pertinent to why the question was asked relative to a wildcat strike and why that is significant here. Because Mr. Roos clearly in his testimony agreed that some kind of unauthorized action was subject to the penalties of Section 4. Now, once he agrees that some kind of unauthorized action is subject to the penalties of Section 4, it then becomes up to the court to determine whether the unauthorized actions would include work stoppages, strikes, or other concerted interference with the operations of the employer. It does not become then Mr. Roos's province to determine that. I would also turn the what I think is the more significant quote to 123 of the joint appendix, in which Mr. Roos, hopefully I have the page right, I'm sure I do, in which Mr. Roos was asked a series of simple questions. At first he said, well, I don't think this kind of a stoppage is covered by Section 1. I said, okay, fine. Section 3 requires the union to do away with the authorization or in order to absolve themselves of liability to take certain actions not to authorize. I says, was it an unauthorized action, whether or not described in Section 3? In other words, was what they engaged in an unauthorized action? It was an unauthorized action by the members. If it was an unauthorized action as described in Section 3, in other words, if it was in fact an unauthorized action which Section 3 was referring to, are the employees under Section 4 subject to discipline? Yes, they shall be subject to discipline. That's the president of the union. Now remember, we have two parties to a contract. We have the employer and we have the union. The employer certainly thought it violated the no-strike clause. And it seems to me clear that the union certainly thought it violated the no-strike clause. In fact, the only one who doesn't think it violated the no-strike clause was an ALJ. Even the board in its decision doesn't analyze the ALJ's conclusion that it only applied to unauthorized actions. It makes no comment on it at all in terms of of its own analysis.
Mr. Budd, am I correct in thinking this about the structure of your argument, that that if you're wrong about this provision or about the contract point, that it's still your, it would be your position that the activity, if not in violation of the contract, is nonetheless unprotected by Section 7?
Yes, that's my section. That's my next topic, which is that assuming for the moment that there were no contract here, there were no no-strike clause, the activity is still unprotected. And in the brief, we cited a myriad of cases, primarily starting with Gulf Coast and some others, all indicating that employees who simply leave jobs to go to union meetings for one reason or another, where there's not an immediate dispute,
or an excusable necessity in Washington.
Right, correct. That if they go to meetings, they are inviolate. It's an unprotected activity. That the employer has a right in its prerogative to expect work time to be used for work time. The board, and this I don't think is completely explained, so I want to go through it in some detail. The board relies almost exclusively on Washington Aluminum, the Supreme Court case. And Washington Aluminum is different in this, from this case, in very substantial respects.
I understand the difference between this case and that. Let me, at least for my purpose, you don't have to explain that, but let me set forth a chain of argument and tell me what's wrong with it. Okay, so the Supreme Court in East Tech said that the question of what's covered activity in this circumstance is in the first instance up to the board. Courts are supposed to defer, assuming it's reasonable, because this is committed to the board. The board looks at the cases that you set, that you describe, namely Gulf and I think GK, and these are distinguishable on the grounds that in GK, I think the language in GK is that they did it for their own reasons. That is, a union meeting whose purpose was unrelated to their own concerns. And it distinguishes Gulf on the ground that in Gulf, the board's reason was that the respondents, that there was a known established reporting rule, which was cited. That neither of those are cited in this case, and then if you look at the footnote of Chairman Batista as the narrowest ground for supporting the case, he says that in the particular exigencies of this case, it's covered activity, the respondent planned to close the facility, the changes marked a particularly vulnerable time for these employees who were caught up in the transition, they were not getting answers to the critical questions about whether they would retain their employment. They absented themselves for only 3 hours. They didn't think that that would harm the, because of the differences in the shifts, that would be a problem. And the chairman says he doesn't hold that this means any kind of information gathering is always a basis for a work stoppage. But in this circumstance, in this narrow, perhaps not to be repeated too many other times circumstance, that's the board's view about what's protected, and we should defer to that view. Even if in some other cases where there are different circumstances, we wouldn't. What's wrong with that line of analysis? It's really based on our obligation to defer to the board if they're reasonably
interpreting the statute. Well, the obligation to defer to the board is based upon at least a reasonable following of the case law, that the board reasonably follow the case law. That's
board,
not to say that you
the
can't.
The board can distinguish its prior cases.
It can
just as we do. I mean, as long as there are, I mean, they yes. didn't overrule the others. They just distinguished.
And you can determine whether or not that those distinctions are reasonable.
Exactly.
And in this right. case, it seems to me that they are clearly not reasonable. First of all, at the time that this occurred, there was no issue relative to moving. If I think you check the record, I don't think the decision to move and the statement to move was made until the May 29th meeting.
So that's a fact question, right? And even on that fact question, we have to defer to the board. About whether
they didn't make a finding on that fact.
Well, they say that this was a time of particular sensitivity because the respondent planned to close the facility, and they were not getting answers to the critical questions about whether they're going to keep their jobs or not. That's what they say. Now, that may be wrong. That's sort of a substantial evidence question about whether they're wrong about those factual predicates.
It would be more than that, but it's not a question whether there was rumors around of them planning to do it. It certainly wasn't in any way down the line where some activity had to be taken. Another very clear problem. In other words, it wasn't the decision to merge was not far enough down the line on May 29th. That anything had to be done, that the union was meeting, had one meeting, I believe, before that for the purpose of negotiating both the decision and the effects, and was meeting on that date for that purpose.
According to the facts stated in the opinion, it says the facility closed the following day.
No. That's in June. May 29th when the...
Right, you're right.
It was 2 weeks later. Right. More than 2 weeks later.
Does 2 weeks sound like, 2 weeks after this meeting, the facility closed? 2 weeks doesn't sound like a very long time.
Well, there was certainly plenty of time to meet and negotiate effects and things of that nature.
There were, but if what they're saying is that 2 weeks before the whole thing is going to close, employees are legitimately concerned about whether they're going to keep their job, I'm not sure why the 2 weeks is significant. If you were going to tell me, I thought you were going to tell me it was months later, but... 2 weeks doesn't sound like much. You'd like to know more than 2 weeks.
Well, we didn't know on the 29th how long it was going to be because it depended upon a liquor license. But the reality is that at that time there was nothing going on to lead to the anxiety which was determined by the board. Nor is that anxiety enough, in my opinion, based on the precedents, to permit employees to leave where they are union represented. And that's going to get us into Judge Black's statement in Washington Aluminum. And why I think Washington Aluminum is an important case for us, not for the board.
Wait, Justice Black's dissent, you mean?
What? No. The majority opinion.
What did he say in this?
Can we just hold back 1 second?
I'm sorry.
Mr. Budd, if I understood your point, was it that on the day when the employees walked off, on the day in question, no one knew that the closing would occur in 2 weeks?
No.
All they knew is it would occur when the board got around to determining the liquor license.
On the 29th, the employer knew immediately prior to the 29th. On the 29th, the union and the employer had not yet met to discuss the fact that it was closing. So that on the 29th, they didn't actually know it was closing, according to what I read in the appendix, in the record.
Because the liquor control people hadn't acted.
Because a decision hadn't been made. But on the 29th, the decision was imparted to the union that they were now going to do it, and they didn't know when because the liquor control people then had to determine when you could go to one facility or the other.
The first bargaining session?
No, the first bargaining session was on the 13th, in which I believe the 13th, I'm going from memory now, but I believe it was on the 13th when the union was told that this was being contemplated.
So on the 13th, the union's told, and the employees learned that as well?
Yes, they would have learned that, presumably, from the union.
Yeah, right. The second meeting is on the 19th. 29th,
I think, 29th. Was the next. I think if you look at the letters, the employer offered earlier meetings, but there was no availability until the 29th.
So in response to Chairman Batista's perception that this was a particularly vulnerable time and they weren't getting answers and so on, it wasn't that the closing was imminent. It was simply that it was being negotiated. The terms were being negotiated for when and if it occurs.
Yeah, and there were no answers to give at that time.
Okay, and I suppose, at least based on your brief, they just should have waited for their representative to tell them after the meeting what came out.
I think that's required under Washington Aluminum. Now that's, I thought there'd be a shock.
Before you respond to my shock, the testimony is that they thought that the company might shut down the next day. Now, in some point, we have to evaluate whether the reasonableness of the employee's action, that is, whether the employees had reason to fear that, even if you hadn't decided that, The fact that it did shut down 2 weeks later suggests that this was not a totally unreasonable fear that it was going to shut down at any moment.
It would not be an unreasonable fear to believe when the discussions occurred is that there was considering merging into one location, whether it be Vetrana's location or Burt's location, they were contemplating moving into location. It wouldn't be unreasonable for people to fear that would take place at some time in the relatively near future. I don't know how else to answer that. I mean, whether that's enough for people to go walking off a job while their union is meeting to negotiate those very topics seems to me to be a bit strained. Now getting to Washington Aluminum, which I think has been, in my opinion, relied on improperly. Washington Aluminum was a case where employees, as you know, walked off the job because of the temperatures in the building, the freezing temperatures in the building, saying that they had discussed it with the employer before, and nothing had happened. And that day, the furnace broke down, it was freezing, they walked off the job in order to cure something which was immediate. It was happening on that occasion. The Fourth Circuit said, wait a second, that's indefensible. The employer has a right to protect his work time. You don't have a right to simply walk off, and you didn't do anything to grieve or complain about that action, and that therefore you are engaging in unprotected activity. The Supreme Court disagreed. But why did they disagree? That's an important element here. Judge Black points out that, quote, the employees had no bargaining representative and no established procedure by which they could take full advantage of their unanimity of opinion in negotiations with the company. Quote, this we think was enough to justify the board's holding that they were not required to make any more specific demand than they did to be entitled to the protection of Section 7. Here there is a bargaining representative. Here there was a collective bargaining agreement. And here the collective bargaining agreement contained a grievance procedure. And here the union, in fact, filed grievances in connection with this very movement.
You're right that all this shows that Washington Aluminum does not decide this case in favor of the board. But Washington Aluminum doesn't say under what other circumstances, if the board made a determination, we would have to defer to it. In fact, Washington Aluminum is before Chevron or any of the deference cases anyway, so it's a little hard to know, you know, what kind of approach it was applying. But I actually am inclined to agree with you that Washington Aluminum is not a particularly strong case. It sets forth sort of general ideas, but it doesn't say those are the only circumstances in which employees are protected.
Well, then you're in the question of the board making new laws because there are no other cases. Well, the other cases which are before you are close enough to this one that you would be looking at a complete turnaround of the law, and I don't believe you should be deferring to that without an explanation. If first of saying Washington Aluminum doesn't apply, now board explain how these other cases don't apply.
It doesn't apply. It's that this case isn't the same as that case. It has some.
Well, I think,
but it's not enough to decide it.
And I think that Justice Black's statements in Washington Aluminum indicate that the Supreme Court felt in Washington Aluminum that had there been a collective bargaining agreement with a grievance procedure and union representation, the actions taken in Washington Aluminum would have ended up being unprotected. That seems to me Justice Black's quote. That's what he said. Now, he didn't go to the next step. He didn't say that would happen, but he did say that those two crucial elements were necessary in order for them to make the finding they did in Washington Aluminum. I want to quickly comment on the simple.
If Gulf and Terry Lee were not here, if there were no other cases, we just had Washington Aluminum.
Yeah, I'd be citing Washington Aluminum in our favor.
But the board would be, the board's burden would only be to analogize the facts here to Washington Aluminum and not have to distinguish its other cases, which is part of the decision.
More difficult for them, but I mean, it seems to me that Washington Aluminum under facts, which are certainly more prone to be protected than here, that the Supreme Court said even there they were unprotected, would have been unprotected had they had a union representative and a contract with a grievance procedure.
I don't think you want to stake your all on Washington.
No, I don't stake my all on anything, Your Honor. Whatever, any argument you'll buy, I'll take.
Okay. In the brief, you're arguing that there's Washington Aluminum and there are these other cases, and they've said this is like Washington Aluminum and that can't be squared with the other cases, right?
But one other factor, because I know I'm out of time, I've already run off my time, so I want to just quickly say that the reliance on the failure of questions is seemed to me an anomaly here, because the board says, well, the employees couldn't get answers from the employer or the union, and therefore they had a right to do what they did. Remember what the questions were. The questions were, are we going to get severance? Are we going to get jobs? Are we going to be transferred to one location or another? And questions of that sort. All mandatory subjects of bargaining. We're here on an 8A5 case because we answered a shop steward's question on severance. And any attempt by the company to answer any of those questions without negotiating with the union, without meeting with the union, would have been bypassing, would have been a clear 8A5. So what the board is saying here is that for us to make sure they didn't have a basis for walking out, we had to go to those employees and answer any questions they had about jobs they were going to get, severance they were going to get, rates of pay they were going to get, whether the contract was going to apply, all of which we had no right to tell them. It would have been illegal.
You say you've been damned because you do, and damned because you do.
That's correct.
And two other things. The shop steward told them not to go, right?
Yes.
And number two, they knew.
And the two union officials told them not to go.
And they knew that it wasn't just the company they were going to see, that the company was meeting with their own union.
Correct. Right. And and also there is no evidence that they would have stopped at the end of 3 hours. Without the union telling them.
I think Mr. Fleischer can have a chance.
May it please the court, I'm David Fleischer representing the National Labor Relations Board. I guess the best place to start is with the contract, because our view is that Section 4, which authorizes discipline or discharge for employee job actions, such job actions in violation of the contract, Section 4 itself does not define what job actions are in violation of the contract, so you have to go back to the earlier sections, and our position is Section 1 is the only one that substantively defines what job actions are in violation of the contract. Section 3, which also has the concept of such job actions, and it merely says given a job action that would be in violation of the contract, what does the union have to do to make sure it can't be sued? I would also note that
let me ask about that. Job actions referred to in 3 have to be unauthorized, right? Because the union is being asked to say they're unauthorized.
Well, that doesn't follow the because Section 3 again has the term the above job actions. Well, the only job actions that are listed above are the authorized ones.
That's if you use the word authorized rather than the word strike, work stoppage, or other concerted interference as being the job actions.
Well, but authorized is authorized in Section 1 modifies the phrase.
I guess there would be two ways to read it. whether authorized modifies it or not. But Section 3, doesn't that seem to suggest that they're not, that the words job actions refer to the unmodified phrase? Isn't Section 3 about unauthorized actions?
No, it's about the above job actions, and the above job actions are only authorized ones. I would also point out that
why is the union being asked to say that they're unauthorized?
Because if the union is being told, if you authorize these things, not only can the employees be fired for doing them, but you yourself can be held liable in damages. And I would also point out, to the extent there's ambiguity under Metropolitan Edison, the right to strike is the kind, waiver of the right to strike is the kind of waiver that has to be clear and unmistakable. It's not the kind of waiver that's subject to contract coverage analysis that applies to 8A5 cases, where it's the right to bargain, which if it's covered by the contract, that right has not so much been waived as exercised. And here, where the right that's in issue either has or has not been waived, you certainly can't say it's been exercised, therefore waiver is irrelevant. The statements of union, he was later union president, Roos, as to what he thought the contract meant, apart from his strange definition of wildcat strikes, he was all over the place in his testimony. He said, well, I think it's covered, I'm not sure. Later he said it was, and then at one point he said it wasn't. But all of this really is not controlling, because he wasn't president of the union when the clause was negotiated. He wasn't even on the negotiating committee. He never participated in a grievance. Relying on his interpretation is like relying on somebody who comes to Congress 20 years after a statute is enacted as to what the Congress that enacted it meant. The other issue in the case is whether, assuming no breach of contract, the employee's action was somehow unprotected. And Washington Aluminum does not say on the facts before it, and only on those facts, an employee walkout is protected. It says an concerted activity for mutual aid or protection is protected unless it falls into one of several categories. Breach of contract would have been one. We've already discussed that. The only one of the others that might arguably apply here is indefensible, and simply the fact that it occurs on working time doesn't without more make it indefensible.
Is that the rubric under which Gulf case and Terry Lee were decided?
Well, those cases held you can't walk out simply to engage in what's essentially union activity, and indeed in those cases it was either organizational type activity or grievance activity.
Are those listed in Washington Aluminum?
No, Washington Aluminum leaves. Washington Aluminum is followed by East Tex, which leaves it to the board in the first instance to define protected activity.
Categories in Washington Aluminum. The only one even arguably applicable here is that it's indefensible. So presumably, by your interpretation, Terry Lee and Gulf were instances of indefensible behavior. Is that correct?
I think that's the principle on which they were decided.
So walking off the job at the time determined by the employees rather than the employer, in those cases, to do union business, was indefensible.
Yes. Now, although we don't necessarily think of it as an exception, of course, the controlling view in the board's decision here is that of Chairman Batista, and he makes it clear that you can't always walk off whenever you feel like gathering interesting information or even information that might have some relevance to working conditions. This is a situation where it was the most basic of working conditions, namely whether the employees that would have a job at all was in issue. They were not just seeking information from their union, which although they hadn't been able to get it from their union, that conceivably could have been done off the job, but they were asking the employer's head directly what's going to happen to us, and they also as one of them also testified, they also wanted to show both the employer and the union were not just names on a list, were statistics, were people. We're not just statistics, were people. And as far as it being clear that the merger was going to take place, which would threaten their jobs, the record at pages 259-260 of the appendix describes what happened at the May 13th meeting, and it was one of the employer's witnesses, I forget which one, specifically told the union that they had evaluated both the Bristol and Bethel facilities and they had made a decision to consolidate all the work in Bethel. That decision in and of itself was not a mandatory subject of bargaining, only the effects of it were. As far as how much notice the employees would have, they were aware basically that the decision had been made. They didn't know what the time frame was. Two of them were people who had been laid off by a previous employer with no notice at all. They were afraid that the same thing was going to happen again, and the actual time frame turned out to be 2 weeks, and certainly that can't be considered unreasonably far in the future.
Here's what Chairman Batista said in part. They weren't getting answers to critical questions regarding whether they would retain employment, and if so, what their security and pay would be. Now, those are all part of the effects bargaining, aren't they?
Yes.
So those were mandatory subjects on which the union was, in fact, engaging the employer.
Yes. However,
did the union violate some duty of fair representation here in failing to apprise the employees?
Or well,
was it acting in a legitimate capacity?
Well, there's no as far as I know, no one ever filed a charge to that effect, and the board did not suggest that happened.
The union is bargaining, the employer is bargaining with the union over the effects, but the employees are impatient with the result, or for a result, and so they absent themselves from work in order to attend the session after the union tells them they can't really attend.
Well, once the union told them they couldn't attend the whole session, they said that we just want to speak briefly with the employer representatives, and they did speak for a very few minutes and then tried to go back to work.
If this had occurred on the plant, at the plant, in other words, they left their stations and went up to the manager's office and made their purpose clear and then went back to work, it'd be a good deal less intrusive.
Well, the time frame would have been probably, in such a situation, the time lost would have been less. I would note that the credited testimony of the steward Everett, a man who was not in favor of the job action, was that by the time they got back to the plant, they could still have completed all except four or five of the run scheduled for that day, and furthermore, to the extent
I don't think that's central here. It seems to me central is who decides.
Well,
employees have the right to decide that they'll defer making the deliveries until later in the day, or is that the exclusive province of the employer?
Well, it is significant that the employer had never before disciplined any employee for failing to make a delivery on the day it was due. They'd always let them make the delivery the next day.
Does the record show what reasons there were that the employees failed sometimes to make all their deliveries?
Well, sometimes it's not entirely clear in the record, and admittedly, there is no showing that the employees deliberately engaged in a work stoppage.
If somebody got caught in traffic, or somebody's wife was having a baby, or what have you, and nobody was harmed as a result, and no one disciplined.
Well, of course, whether nobody was harmed is as much a matter of opinion in that situation as this.
The employer excused the delay. It didn't feel aggrieved, right, in all these other instances.
And I would also note that that as far as harm to the employer, that when the employees did try to go back to work, the employer, even though it had no one at that time to complete the deliveries that the employees could still have made that day, it didn't let them. And so it was willing, obviously, to let all the deliveries rather than four or five be put over till the next day.
Whenever an employer suspends or discharges an employee, it's willing to take the consequences of having no one to do the work until someone else is hired. That just comes with the territory. Are there any further questions?
I have just two quick questions. The separate finding of unfair labor practice related to anti-union animus in the failure to rehire, is that independent or not independent of the finding that that they were fired for protected activity? That is, if we were to find that it was not protected activity, or for whatever reason they were able to, the employer was not there was no unfair labor practice in the firing, would the finding with respect to the rehiring be independent of that?
Well, although there is independent evidence of union animus, there is a problem in terms of that. The fact that the employer's stated ground for not rehiring was that it had fired these people, and if it fired them lawfully, then it would probably have a right-line defense based on that. But we, of course, contend that it was an unlawful firing, and can't be a right-line defense.
Even if they have a right-line defense, it can be overcome by sufficient evidence of anti-union animus, but what you're saying is that wasn't the analysis that was followed in this case, because it was assumed that the firing was not appropriate. Is that right?
Yes.
All right, one other quick question. There's discussion about whether this was really a strike or not a strike. There is a difference between a strike, a work stoppage, and a concerted interference. If the contract, if the CBA actually prohibited, unauthorized, and then in the language of the CBA, strike, work stoppage, or other concerted interference, would that make it unprotected?
Well, anything that's in breach of contract is normally unprotected,
yes,
and there's no suggestion that this is an exception to that.
So this would come within that clause if it applied to unauthorized.
Well, of course, our view is that authorized modifies all three of the kinds of actions referred to.
I understand. If you're wrong about that, does the activity of the employees in this case come within the rubric of strike, work stoppage, or other concerted interference?
Well, it would be hard put to say it wasn't a work stoppage.
I agree. I'm only asking that because it seemed like ALJ was putting an awful lot into this isn't really a strike, and then without considering the others. But you're not putting much into that.
Well, our position is, however it's described, it's not a breach of contract.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Good morning, Your Honor. I've reserved 15 of my 2 minutes for... No, I'm kidding. I want to use my 2 minutes to address the contract interpretation issue and just try to put it into some context, because I think the context is really important. This is not a situation where you're dealing with an issue of whether a union was waiving its own rights to bargain, like under the contract coverage doctrine that Judge Silverman was so fond of. This is a situation where the question is, does this contract language clearly and unmistakably waive the rights of these individual employees to engage in Section 7 activity that's not union activity? It's a concerted activity for mutual aid and protection. So, there's no question, although the employer disputes this in the brief, there's no question that this court's rulings, particularly the local 1395 case, which the respondent relies on, make clear that such a waiver of individual employee rights has to be clear and unmistakable. So, and the second part of it, it's an affirmative defense of the employer, assuming the activity is protected. So you have an affirmative defense, and the question is, has the employer proven, have met its affirmative defense of showing that the parties intended to clearly and unmistakably waive the rights of these individual union members to engage in this protected activity? And the stark contrast between the language in this contract, which clearly on its face does not waive any rights of individual employees to engage in protected activities. I understand.
Could you put your last 1 minute on whether this is protected or not in the first place?
Sure. But could I just tell you the language the language in Local 1395 case? The contract said, during the term of the agreement and any extension or renewal thereof, the union and the employee covered and the employees covered shall not. That is profoundly different from the language here, and all members of the board agreed that this does not constitute a waiver of unauthorized activity. With respect to I would do the same thing with respect to the question of whether the conduct is protected. This is a very unique and unusual set of circumstances. And the question is not whether the board's interpretation of the act in this circumstance was reasonable. It's whether it was reasonably defensible. And the question about whether a certain set of activities, particularly a unique set of activities...
Excuse me, whether the board's interpretation was reasonably defensible, whether the conduct was defensible?
No, it's whether the board's, and this is in... I actually wrote down the sites. I can't remember which cases. The Supreme Court case and one of your cases, both of which are cited in the board's brief. It's a standard review question. It's a question of whether when you're determining whether certain activity is protected by the act, the question is, and the board's decided that it is, it's not a de novo review. It's not like what your court does with contract interpretation, in which you do a de novo review. It's whether the board's interpretation of the act in determining that this particular conduct comes under the rubric of Section 7 activity is a reasonably defensible application interpretation of the act. So it is really a level of review question.
You didn't brief this question, did you?
I didn't brief this issue because I thought the board's brief actually was excellent on this issue, and I was concerned about my client's testimony, so I wanted to make sure I addressed that issue.
Let me say, yours was one of the, unfortunately, relatively rare green briefs that was helpful. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. would you like me to speak more about the protected activity?
If you think that the board covered it, then?
Yeah, why not end on a high note?
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Case is submitted.